The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Yeah, good morning. It's been a little while since I've been here on a Sunday morning. One of the reasons is because I often teach on Sunday nights and have a group for the last 12 or 13 years that's particularly oriented for people in their 20s and 30s. So this is also a shameless plug for the Sunday night group. But teaching for that community has been one of the highlights of my teaching career. I was asked by Gil to start the group when I started my teacher training in 2013. And, you know, I said, nah, I don't think so. at that point, the idea was just to do it once a month. And that to me seemed like a huge commitment every month, you know. And then Gil was like, well, you know, think about it. And I think you should do something. And so in January of 2013, we had the first session. And then it was a great learning for me because, you know, I think at that time there was, you know, people who were in their 20s especially were few and far between in the Sangha. You know, in the 25 years I've been, you know, with Gil, and it's always sort of had an older demographic. And so I think, you know, there was interest, but I didn't know, would anyone show up, you know? And I just said to myself, I'm going to show up every Sunday, no matter what. And I don't think there was ever a Sunday that I was just by myself, you know, that would have been okay, but a little sad. But it was like the learning for me was that when I made the commitment and just started showing up, people started coming. And then little by little, it grew and grew. And then we once a month, we said, well, we want to meet more often. So, okay, we'll meet twice a month. And, oh, we want to meet every Sunday. Okay, we'll meet every, you know. And I think part of it was that because I was committed to showing up every Sunday, it was like people could trust that. You know, so sort of like here, you know, Sunday mornings, you sort of know something's going to be happening on Sunday mornings. You don't have to think about it or wonder. And you can just show up and you can, you know, and someone will be here. Something's happening. So that was a great learning for me. And, I remember when I first started sitting, with this community in, late 1999. So it's a long time ago. Before we had this building, we were in the Quaker Friends, meeting house. I don't know if anyone remembers that. It's there. Yeah. It's a while ago. And I remember the first time I came, and it was like, I don't think there was much guided meditation then. So you kind of just come in. And a friend brought me. I didn't really, you know, have a lot of context. But it was like you come in, you sit down in silence, and then someone gives a talk, a very kind of quiet, gentle talk. And it's very quiet. And then everyone would leave in silence, in total silence. And so there's something beautiful about it. And I just remembered how leaving from, usually it was Gil, you know, the talk, and going into the neighborhood in Palo Alto, and it was so magical. It was so quiet and magical, and it just, there was something about that silence that was special for me. It felt different, and it was meeting some kind of need I had. But then for the 20s and 30s group, you know, I sort of realized that, especially at that age and that stage of life and development, there's a strong, I think, wish and need for connection and for this kind of, you know, this, you know, I think in psychological terms, that phase of development is sometimes characterized by the struggle between intimacy and isolation, you know, and people, you know, want to connect and want, you know, and so we, you know, the Sunday night program is much more interactive than anything I ever had here. And, you know, people kind of go in small groups and talk and so that's been nice. So I had a little question in my mind, that I'm hoping this talk will address a little bit. A couple of questions. One is, why are we doing this? Whenever I come back after a while and, you know, I sit down and I'm okay, you know, I give myself sort of beginner meditation. You know, I sit up straight and breathe and, you know, and then we go, why am I doing this again? You know, so that's a question. And then another question, maybe related to that, is something like, what makes this practice a spiritual practice or a religious practice, or, you know, and I think we each probably have our own relationship to that word, religion or spirituality. And, you know, is this that for you? Is it, you know, I think it certainly doesn't have to be. I think Gil once had a very nice way of explaining the relationship between mindfulness and Buddhism. You know, and he said, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he said something like, mindfulness, you know, is a quality, is a skill, is a way of being that, you know, is kind of universal. It can exist perfectly well without Buddhism. You know, and you kind of see in our culture the way that mindfulness has just, you know, really sort of exploded in interest and popularity. I think that's a good thing. I'm a little bit now in the world of psychology and psychotherapy and doing training in that world. And mindfulness is a huge thing in therapy. And so mindfulness can really stand on its own, you know, and is a quality that is, you know, known to be helpful for many things. And we can feel it. We can feel how obviously helpful it can be. And then so mindfulness can be independent. It can certainly be without Buddhism. But Buddhism, you know, doesn't exist without mindfulness. You know, maybe you could say Buddhism is a religion of mindfulness. And so that's, you know, I think that's a nice way of thinking about it. And I was, part of the reason this is on my mind is I recently came back from a short trip to a Zen monastery called Tassajara. Some of you may know Tassajara. It's the mountain sort of retreat center of the San Francisco Zen Center. And it's a special place for me, I think for many people. It's about 2 or 3 hours drive south from here in sort of between Carmel Valley and Big Sur. But you can't get to it from Big Sur. You drive in through Carmel Valley. And even just getting there is a journey. It's like, you start on the freeways and then you go to the two-lane roads. And then there's a little house, a little town or something. I think it's like one building called Jamesburg. And that's sort of the landing station. And then from Jamesburg, it's about 13 miles, like into the mountains, but it's a dirt road and it takes an hour. And that's with like a 4x4, kind of car. So it's like a whole thing to get there. It's not like a place you drop in. And there's no cell phone service. When I lived there, like 20 years ago, the letters, you could get mail and you write letters and there's one payphone, it's kind of, but people can't call you. You could call out kind of thing. And so just by the nature of its geography, it's secluded. And it's a valley that was, I think, a special place for certain Native American groups. And there are these wonderful natural hot springs there. So, it was sort of the perfect spot for a Japanese Buddhist group to find, because if you know Japan, there's many natural hot springs in Japan called onsen. And onsen is like a big part of life in Japan, this group communal bathing experience. And it's wonderful. And so when Zen Center got this land in the mid 60s or the late 60s, they created these Japanese bathhouses there, which have been sort of rebuilt over the years. But it was a wonderful experience for me, because I think I haven't been back there in maybe 10 years or 12 years. And like I said, it was 20 years when I lived there. But just to go and take a bath and to smell, the water has this sulfur, this rich sulfur smell, and it's so great. The reason that I was there was because my Zen teacher, Mel Weitzman, who was the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center for, more than 50 years, he passed away in 2021 when he was, I think he was 91. And so this event was a ceremony to put some of his ashes at the sort of memorial garden at Tassajara. I think some of his ashes are at the Berkeley Zen Center, and then some of them were at Tassajara. So I was thinking of Mel, and Mel had such a long career life in practice and in Buddhism and in teaching. He was Gil's first teacher when Gil was in college, in the mid 70s. So, and it was one of my favorite times of teaching retreat was, I think, twice Gil and Mel and I taught a retreat together at our center at IRC. So this was an event to kind of honor Mel, and there was a whole ceremony. But it did make me think about the sort of form of practice in a monastery like Tassajara. And it's like I don't know how to explain it exactly, but it is a place, and I think other Buddhist monasteries are more or less similar in that the entire practice is structured in a very particular way. And when you stay there, you sort of surrender to the structure. There are bells, and every bell sort of means something. You know, there's a bell to kind of come and sit in the morning. And when I was there, I think it was like 3:50 in the morning or something. You raise pretty early. And, you know, it's not like you're sort of in your room and you think, should I go today, this morning? I think I'm going to sleep in. It's like you need to go, basically. And if you don't go, you know, there's a knock on your door. Max, are you okay? You know, if you're sick or something, it's different. But I was often part of this group of stragglers who they would come around and collect and bring you in. A little bit of like a walk of shame, not really, but you know, it was so hard for me to wake up in the morning. And one of the reasons is I would stay up late in my room reading, you know, and there was no internet, there was no phones or anything like that, but we had these kerosene lamps. And so I would love to get these books. There's a little library in Tassajara that all these great Dharma books. So I would have these books in my room and I would be up late reading. Of course, I couldn't get up for meditation in the morning. But it's like, in a way, it's challenging to live in a monastery because there's so much structure and you can't really do what you want. Your job is to just follow the schedule. And, you know, and there's work and there's meditation and there was class and then, you know, bath time and all these things. So if you really want to do your own thing, it's going to be hard. But little by little, you know, over the months that I lived there, I noticed myself being more and more willing to give myself over to the form of practice that was there. And so, you know, there's certain times that you meditate. And when you meditate, it's not just like, oh, I'm going to bring my, you know, my beach chair and my, you know, all my sort of supports. It's like you sit on this very particular cushion and you face the wall, and then the teacher is watching you. Sitting out, everyone's facing out, you know, the wall, and the teacher's facing in and watching. So if you slouch, and you know, in Zen, there's a big emphasis of sitting up straight and don't move. So if you move, they're going to notice you. Oh, I'm moving. And so there's this kind of intensity to the practice. I don't know if I'm doing a good job of communicating it. When I practice Zen in Japan, if you start to move or start to fidget or you start to fall asleep and, you know, kind of, you'll feel something on your shoulder, which is a certain kind of long wooden stick. So you really do get a spanking, so to speak. It's called the keisaku, which was translated here as the wake-up stick. And it actually can feel really wonderful if the person knows the right place to hit you. Because there are muscles right there, right? And, you know, kind of, and that can get really tight when you've been sitting a long time. So they just go, poof. You know, you kind of bow, and they bow, and it's a whole ritual. Unfortunately, in Japan, it was often the young, really new, eager monks, these kind of young guys. And you know, if they hit the bone, it's like, oh my God, it's excruciating. But in American Zen, they've largely done away with the stick. You know, it's just, it's not. People don't react well to it. But it's sort of like, it makes, when it's done in the kind of traditional way, it makes this booming sound. And I remember when I was living at Tassajara, Mel, who was the teacher there for that practice period, you know, he was kind of old school, so he still used the stick. But the student had to request it. So, you know, there's a certain, you know, if you're sitting and you're feeling sleepy, you could request it. And then he would come by and, but just that sound would electrify the room. And, you know, so there's a lot of structure in a place like this. But interestingly, the one thing there wasn't, the one thing that I was looking for, the reason I wanted to go there, but there was almost none of it, was meditation instruction. Isn't that a little interesting? That there was all of this teaching and training about when you walk into the meditation hall, you always, I can't remember now, but I think it was, you step in with your right foot, then you walk in, and then you bow like this, and then you do this, and then you, so all of these forms, but when you finally sit down on the cushion, and it was like, okay, now what? And they're like, you know, and so that was a koan for me. That was kind of a riddle, you know, koan, this kind of idea of like this paradox. What's the sound of one hand clapping or, you know, this kind of thing. It's not something that we figure out with our logical mind or our conscious mind. So it was really a riddle. You know, you sit down, you finally get to your seat and you're in this posture. And you don't move, sit up straight, don't move, put your hands like this, you know. But then you were totally left alone. And at first I really struggled with that because I thought, you know, what's the instruction? What's the teaching? What about mindfulness of breathing? What about all, you know, I knew I've heard many of Gil's talks by that time and, you know, so I had some Vipassana instruction but there was just, you know, if there was anything that they would say, it would be something like, sort of like to be this moment, you know, which depending on your mood or something could be helpful or not, but it's like, what I learned, I don't know if this was the right, you know, the thing I was supposed to learn, but what I learned is that there was something incredibly important and beautiful and profound in that space that we were given. Not told how to be, not told what to do, not told what to notice, but it was like this radical openness and this radical permission that only each of us can give ourselves to leave ourselves alone. You know, and there's something, I think we're so conditioned to be doing something and to be improving ourselves and to be training in something and to be, you know, those are all good things. It's great to develop in skills and capacities. And I think that's part of the way that mindfulness as its own thing, as a secular thing, is a skill. It's like playing the piano. It's like anything, right? It's like we learn how to do that and that can be very helpful. But this wasn't quite that. this was like, can I stop? So it was like, can I stop harming myself, first of all, with all this talk, self-talk, and can I give myself this freedom and this permission to be who and what I am in this moment? You know, that's it. And so for me, coming from a life and a world that was very much like about doing and achieving and succeeding in a certain way and accomplishing, this was like, okay, there's no way I can do it right. There's no way I can do it wrong. There's no such thing as a good sitting. You know, you're off the grid of success and failure. And so for me, something about that opens up this idea of practice as something more than just getting good at something. It's like, you know, it gets to the heart of who we are. And that for me feels like a spiritual, you know, more of the kind of spiritual territory. I came across this quote or this idea from Gregory Bateson, who was a great anthropologist and philosopher. And he said something like, the best way to heal the land, a forest, a lake, is to protect the area from further harm and allow the self-correcting and self-healing mechanisms to come into play. You know, when we stop polluting the water and stop dumping in all this toxicity, then the natural self-healing, self-correcting mechanisms take over. You know, we know that the land, little by little, returns to its natural state. And I think for me, being in that kind of environment at Tassajara, it was like that. It was when I could just back off a little bit, you know, and be quiet and let go of even the projects of, I'm going to get really good at following the breath or, you know, something like that, which is good. You know, it's fine. But to just ease off and let something just rest and heal and give it this space. It was so wonderful. And that unlocked so much for me. And so, you know, most of us probably won't ever go to a place like Tassajara. And even if we go there, you know, it's not a place you can stay, right? It's somewhere that you touch into a certain form of living. And then I think the challenge for me was, how do I bring that into my life? How do I bring that into a life that's only gotten more complicated in those 20 years, you know? And Mel, this kind of Zen teacher, used to talk about the forms of everyday life. You know, in a monastery, you have these forms. This is how you bow. This is how you ring the bell. This is how you do this. In our life, we also have forms. We don't necessarily recognize them as such. If you have children, you know one of the forms, or if you remember, if your kids are, you know, older, one of the forms are the rituals, all the rituals that come along with being a child and raising a child. You know, there's the bedtime ritual, right? And children, it turns out, like Buddhist monks, children really thrive on ritual and thrive on consistency and structure. You know, it's not good for a child to have no structure. Oh, go to bed whenever you want. Brush your teeth if you feel like it. You know, take whatever you want from the fridge and eat it. You know, it's going to be dinner of ice cream and French fries. And structure for a child is a way of feeling loved and feeling cared for and supported. So I was, you know, I was in the monastery before I had children. And then having young children, I could feel how these forms, if I saw them as forms, if I saw them as practice opportunities, were so helpful and sort of changed my mind. So rather than, another school run and taking them to school and this and that, you know, and which you do again and again and again, right? Hundreds of times. If it's a form of practice, if it's a ritual, it totally changed the feeling for me. And I imagined, you know, at one point my kids could walk to school and that was lovely. But it was also poignant because I noticed as they got older, they wanted me to walk less and less with them, you know, to kind of disappear earlier and earlier. Until at some point it was like, I was just like on the driveway. I was like, bye, and they're off by themselves, which is good. And then when I was driving them, I would imagine that the car was like this chariot, you know, and that time, that precious time that, you know, you have together. So I think in our life, maybe there's a way that we can reanimate or reimagine all of the things we do, you know, which we have to do, we want to do. One of the things we often say is if you have a sitting practice, you know, at home, you know, there's a difference between just like plopping down anywhere. And that, you know, that's good. It's good. You know, it's great to be able to meditate anywhere. You know, plop down and, okay, I've got 5 minutes. I'll do some breath work or something. You know, that's fine. But like, is there some way that we can create, you know, this kind of sense of care and reverence, just the way that it would be at a temple or a monastery, but in our home, maybe there's an altar that we have photographs of loved ones or, you know, some special artwork that means something to us, you know, and to set aside a place for sitting it does something to our mind. Just as I was saying, like this process of going into Tassajara is, I think, a big part of, you know, it's magic. It's like, it's hard to get there. It takes a lot. And the more you get, you know, you kind of, the last like hour, it's like, boom, 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 you know, and by the time you're there, you're already kind of emptied out, you know. And so what is it to create, you know, that's some kind of sense of that magic in our life. So that's one of the ways for me that, you know, I think it opens up the deeper meaning of the practice. And then the other thing I think about of what makes this practice special, or why do we do this, or what's the deeper meaning of it, maybe is best illustrated by this exchange that Mel, my old teacher, had with a student. At the end of a Zen retreat, there's often a ceremony where the teacher sits in the middle of the room, and each student is invited to come up and give him a question. And then he responds. So it used to be called Dharma Combat. That's a little weird. But it's like a kind of public practice discussion in a way. And it's quick, you know. And sometimes people will ask questions that challenge the teacher in a way. But the best questions, I always think, are really like a heartfelt question that's coming from, you know, the deepest part of you, and you just bring it out, and then the teacher just says something, you know, responds. They may not answer it, but they respond. And sometimes they're funny exchanges. Like when I was living there, there was a teaching we were studying, and a part of this teaching, the translation from the Japanese was encouraging. It said something like, practice like a fool, like an idiot. You know, it's part of this whole longer thing. You know, to kind of have this kind of innocent mind practice. So the student came up and asked Mel, you know, how can I practice like a fool, like an idiot? And Mel looked at him and said, keep going. So all these little exchanges that are very sweet. But I remember someone asked Mel, how can I help others? It's a beautiful question. How can I help others? And Mel said, forget about others. Help yourself. Okay? And, you know, the guy took the bait and he said, how can I help myself? And then immediately Mel said, take care of others. Right? And it took me a while to recognize that maybe the most meaningful marker of maturity in this practice is not necessarily what happens on the cushion in someone's private experience. You know, I used to look at teachers and, you know, Gil for sure, because, you know, as my first teacher, but also in the Zen world, you know, a teacher's seniority it's a little bit like the military is marked by like how many stars are on their, you know, but it's like color-coded robes, you know, so there's like brown robes. It's like a big deal, or this color, or that color. You know, look at these robes. Wow. You know, what's this? What's going on in this person's mind? How they're so enlightened and special, and you know, and maybe you know. But what I realized is that the actual shift in this practice, and maybe the marker of growth and maturity, is how much we're that it's not only this practice is about me and what it's going to do for me and how I'm going to learn and grow and suffer less and be more. It's all great. It's all great things. But there's this shift to thinking about others and taking care of others and, you know, and that for me is also unlocks the deeper meaning and what makes this not only a really, you know, trendy and psychologically useful thing to do, but that makes it, you know, a path of transcendence, you know, that we are in the process of seeing ourselves and taking care of ourselves and studying ourselves. We begin to transcend the kind of small self, you know, and we get interested in other people. And we start to realize that who and what I am is inseparable from who and what you are. And it's sort of like I can't just cut myself off from everyone and everything. It's sort of like I'm going to really take care of my nose or something, you know, and forget about the rest of my body. It's just my nose, you know, or, you know, whatever. So it's like, it doesn't make sense. You know, we start to identify with the whole body. And so when I was at Tassajara this last weekend, it was in between sessions. In the summer, it's open to the public. And in the winter, they have the kind of monastic, the 3-month practice periods. And so this inter period was called the work period. And volunteers come in from all over. And it's often people who are tradespeople, who are contractors and carpenters and have amazing skills. And they come in and, you know, are completely donating their time and build cabins and paint and do all these repairs that are needed. And they were rebuilding the women's bathhouse and it's just amazing, you know, and the joy and that they bring is so inspiring. And, you know, when I think about IMC and IRC, our places, which are totally, you know, by donation, everything here has been donated. You know, so that something about that spirit of kind of opening to this bigger picture, this bigger mind. And so I think we start out in practice inevitably focused on ourselves. Of course we are, you know. And then little by little, over time, I think we start to, something starts to shift. So it's not so much what can mindfulness do for me, but it's like, what can I offer? What can I give? How can I serve? How can I be helpful? And in being helpful, in helping others, something inside us is nourished deeply, you know? And so this wonderful symbiosis or relationship. Maybe I'll end with a little, it's kind of a poem or a little teaching, but in, there was a teacher called Joko Beck. I don't know if anyone remembers her, has read her books, or, you know, she was pretty popular in the 80s and 90s. And she was a little bit unique as a Western woman Zen teacher in a very Asian and sort of male-dominated tradition. And she started the San Diego Zen Center, Zen Center of San Diego. But when she left her teacher and the sort of monastic forms in LA, she gave up the robes. She didn't wear robes. Did she wear robes? I don't think she wore robes. She didn't wear robes. She didn't even have a Buddha on her. On her altar. And, you know, and there's certain aspects of the forms that she kept, but she I don't know if you would say she modernized or she Americanized or she Westernized or something, but it's not that different to what we have here, you know, that we've taken this practice and we have forms here, but they're not, you know, probably someone coming from, you know, a traditional monastery in Burma or Thailand would, you know, no, it's a little different. It's a little different than how it's done there. And that's a question, you know, and for each of us in our life, in our practice, we maybe need to answer that question of why am I doing this? And what will unlock for me the deepest meaning of this practice? It's going to be a different answer for each of us. But so Joko, you know, had this sort of stripped down Zen on the outside. And, she and their community, I don't know who wrote it, maybe it was her, but they reformulated or they translated the Four Noble Truths. Have you heard of the Four Noble Truths? You know, it's this kind of foundational Buddhist teaching of, you know, there is suffering, there's dukkha, there's a cause of suffering, which is usually desire or clinging or attachment, or, and there is an end to suffering, and then that's the third one, and then there's the fourth one is there's a path to the end of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. So that's the traditional Four Noble Truths, but for Joko's community, they formulate a little bit differently. So I'll just share it with you. I think it's kind of fun. But for me, it points to this idea of studying ourself and also going beyond ourself. And so the first one is caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering. Caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering. Second is holding to self-centered thoughts. Exactly the dream. So that's the second noble truth. That each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. So this is the end of suffering, right? Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. And then the path to the end of suffering is the fourth, being just this moment, compassion's way. So caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering, holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Being just this moment, compassion's way. So, yeah, thank you very much.